This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Since We Fell, a novel by Dennis Lehane, performed by Julia Whalen. When you just give love and never get love, you'd better let love depart. I know it's so, and yet I know I can't get you out of my heart. Buddy Johnson, Since I Fell for You. Masked, I Advance. René Descartes. Prologue. After the Staircase. On a Tuesday in May, in her 35th year, Rachel shot her husband dead. He stumbled backward with an odd look of confirmation on his face, as if some part of him had always known she'd do it. He looked surprised, too. She assumed she did as well. Her mother wouldn't have been surprised. Her mother, who never married, wrote a famous book on how to stay married. The chapters were named after stages Elizabeth Childs, Ph.D., had identified in any relationship that began in a state of mutual attraction. The book was entitled The Staircase, and became so successful that her mother was convinced, she'd say coerced, into writing two sequels, Reclimbing the Staircase and Steps of the Staircase, a workbook, each of which sold more poorly than the last. Privately, her mother thought all three books were emotionally adolescent snake oil, but she reserved a wistful fondness for The Staircase because she hadn't been aware, when she was writing it, how little she actually knew. She said this to Rachel when Rachel was 10. That same summer, late into her afternoon cocktails, she told her, "A man is the stories he tells about himself, and most of those stories are lies. Never look too closely. If you uncover his lies, it'll humiliate you both. Best to just live with the bullshit." Then her mother kissed her head, patted her cheek, told her she was safe. Rachel was 7 when The Staircase was published. She remembered the endless phone calls, the flurry of trips, her mother's renewed dependence on smoking, and the desperate, chiseled glamour that overtook her. She remembered a feeling she could barely articulate, that her mother, never happy, grew even more bitter with success. Years later, she'd suspect the reason was because the fame and the money robbed her mother of excuses for her unhappiness. Her mother, brilliant at analyzing the problems of strangers, never had a clue how to diagnose herself. So she spent her life in search of solutions to problems that were born, raised, lived, and died within the boundaries of her own marrow. Rachel didn't know any of that at 7, of course, or even at 17. She only knew that her mother was an unhappy woman, so she was an unhappy child. When Rachel shot her husband, she was on a boat in Boston Harbor. Her husband remained on his feet for only the briefest of time, 7 seconds, 10, before he fell over the stern and into the water. But in those final seconds, a catalog of emotion found his eyes. There was dismay, self-pity, terror, an abandonment so total it took 30 years off his life and turned him into a 10-year-old before her eyes. Anger, of course. Outrage. A sudden and fierce determination, as if, even as the blood spilled from his heart and over the hand he'd cupped below it, he'd be okay, he'd be fine, he'd get through this. He was strong, after all. He'd created everything of value in his life by force of will alone, and he could will himself out of this. Then the dawning realization. No, he couldn't. He looked right at her as the most incomprehensible of emotions staked its claim and subsumed all others. Love. Which was impossible. And yet, there was no mistaking it. Wild, helpless, pure, blooming and splattering in tandem with the blood on his shirt. He mouthed it, as he often did from the other side of crowded rooms, "I love you." And then he fell off the boat and vanished beneath the dark water. 2 days before, if someone had asked her if she loved her husband, she would have said yes. Actually, if someone had asked her the same question as she pulled the trigger, she would have said yes. Her mother had a chapter about that, chapter 13, Discordance. Or was the next chapter, The Death of the Old Narrative, more applicable? Rachel wasn't sure. She got them confused sometimes. 1. Rachel in the Mirror, 1979 to 2010. Chapter 1. 73 Jameses. Rachel was born in the Pioneer Valley of Western Massachusetts. It was known as the region of the five colleges: Amherst, Hampshire, Mount Holyoke, Smith, and the University of Massachusetts, and it employed 2,000 faculty to teach 25,000 students. She grew up in a world of coffee shops, B&Bs, wide town commons, and clabbered houses with wraparound porches and musky attics. In autumn, leaves fell by the tubful and choked the streets, spilled onto sidewalks and clogged fence holes. Some winters, snow encased the valley in silence so dense it became its own sound. In July and August, the mail carrier rode a bicycle with a bell on the handlebar, and the tourists arrived for summer stock theater and antiquing. Her father's name was James. She knew little else about him. She recollected that his hair had been dark and wavy, and his smile sudden and unsure. At least twice he'd taken her to a playground with a dark green slide where the Berkshire clouds hung so low he'd needed to wipe the swing free of condensation before he could place her on it. On one of those trips, he'd made her laugh, but she couldn't recall how. James had been an instructor at one of the colleges. She had no idea which one, or if he'd been an adjunct, an assistant professor, or an associate on tenure track. She didn't even know if he taught at one of the five colleges. He could have been at Berkshire or Springfield Technical, Greenfield CC or Westfield State, or any of a dozen other colleges and junior colleges in the region. Her mother was teaching at Mount Holyoke when James left them. Rachel was just short of three and could never say with certainty if she'd borne witness to the day her father walked out of the house, or if she'd just imagined it to suture the wound his absence left behind. She heard her mother's voice coming through the wall of the small house they'd rented that year on Westbrook Road. "Do you hear me? If you go out that door, I will expunge you." Shortly thereafter, the bump of a heavy suitcase on the stairs out back, followed by the snap of a trunk closing, the rasp and whistle of a cold engine clamoring to life in a small car, then tires crunching winter leaves and frozen dirt, followed by silence. Maybe her mother hadn't believed he'd actually leave. Maybe once he had, she'd assured herself he'd return. When he didn't, her dismay turned to hate, and her hate grew depthless. "He's gone," she said when Rachel was about five and had begun asking persistent questions about his whereabouts. "He wants nothing to do with us, and that's okay, sweetie, because we don't need him to define us." She got down on her knees in front of Rachel and tucked an errant hair behind her ear. "Now, we won't speak of him again, okay?" But of course Rachel spoke of him and asked about him. At first it exasperated her mother. A wild panic would find her eyes and flare her nostrils. But eventually the panic was replaced with a strange, tiny smile. So tiny it was barely a smile at all, just a slight uptick of the right side of her mouth that managed to be smug, bitter, and victorious all at the same time. It would be years before Rachel would see the onset of that smile as her mother's decision, whether conscious or unconscious she'd never know, to make her father's identity the central battleground in a war that colored Rachel's entire youth. Her mother promised to tell her James's last name on her 16th birthday, provided Rachel showed a level of maturity that would suggest she could handle it. But that summer, just before she turned 16, Rachel was arrested in a stolen car with Jared Marshall, whom she'd promised her mother she was no longer seeing. The next target date was her high school graduation. But after an ecstasy-related debacle at the semi-formal that year, she was lucky to graduate at all. If she went to college then, a community college first to get her grades up, then a real one, her mother said, maybe then. They fought continuously over it. Rachel would scream and break things, and her mother's smile would grow colder and smaller. She would repeatedly ask Rachel, why? Why do you need to know? Why do you need to meet a stranger who's never been a part of your life or your financial security? Shouldn't you first take stock of the parts of you that are bringing you such unhappiness before you journey out into the world to find a man who can offer no answers and bring you no peace? Because he's my father, Rachel screamed more than once. He's not your father, her mother said with an air of unctuous sympathy. He's my sperm donor. She said that at the tail end of one of their worst fights, the Chernobyl of mother-daughter spats. Rachel slid down the wall of the living room in defeat and whispered, "You're killing me." "I'm protecting you," her mother said. Rachel looked up and saw, to her horror, that her mother believed that. Far worse, she defined herself by that belief. Rachel's junior year in college, while she was in Boston, sitting in Introduction to British Literary Studies since 1550, her mother blew a red light in Northampton, and her sob was T-boned by a fuel truck driving the speed limit. At first, there was concern that the shell of the fuel truck had been pierced in the accident, but it turned out not to be the case. This was a relief for the fire and rescue crews who came from as far away as Pittsfield. The fuel truck had just topped off, and the intersection was in a dense area by both a senior citizen's home and a basement-level preschool. The driver of the fuel truck suffered mild whiplash and tore a ligament in his right knee. Elizabeth Childs, once famous author, died upon impact. If her national fame had long since subsided, however, her local celebrity still burned bright. Both the Berkshire Eagle and the Daily Hampshire Gazette ran her obituary on the front page, below the fold, and her funeral was well attended, though the gathering back at the house afterward was less so. Rachel would end up donating most of the food to a local homeless shelter. She spoke to several of her mother's friends, mostly women, and one man, Giles Ellison, who taught poli-sci at Amherst and who, Rachel had long suspected, had been her mother's occasional lover. She could tell her assumption was correct by the way the women paid special attention to him and by how little Giles spoke. A normally gregarious man, he kept parting his lips as if he wished to speak, but then changed his mind. He looked around the house like he was drinking it in, as if its contents were familiar and had once brought him comfort. As if they were all he had left of Elizabeth, and he was taking stock of the fact he'd never see them or her again. He was framed by the parlor window that looked down Old Mill Lane on a drizzly April day, and Rachel felt a tremendous pity rise up in her for Giles Ellison, rapidly aging toward retirement and obsolescence. He'd expected to go through that rite of passage with an acerbic lioness by his side, but now he'd go through it alone. It was unlikely he'd find another partner as radiant with intelligence and rage as Elizabeth Childs. And she had been radiant in her own officious, acerbic way. She didn't enter rooms, she swept into them. She didn't engage friends and colleagues, she gathered them to her. She never napped, rarely seemed tired, and no one could ever remember her falling ill. When Elizabeth Childs left a room, you felt it, even if you'd arrived after she'd gone. When Elizabeth Childs left the world, it felt the same way. It surprised Rachel to realize just how little she was prepared for the loss of her mother. She had been a lot of things, most of them not positive in her daughter's opinion, but she had always been so utterly there, and now she was so utterly and so violently gone. But still, the old question persisted, and Rachel's clear access to the answer had died with her mother. Elizabeth may have been unwilling to provide that answer, but she had unquestionably been in possession of it. Now, possibly no one was. However well Giles and her friends and agent and publisher and editor had known Elizabeth Childs, and they all seemed to know a version of her that differed slightly but crucially from the woman Rachel had known, none of them had known her longer than Rachel's lifespan.
"I wish I knew anything about James," Anne Marie McCarron, Elizabeth's oldest friend in the area, told Rachel once they were sufficiently lubricated for Rachel to broach the subject of her father. "But the first time I ever went out with your mother was months after they broke up. I remember he taught in Connecticut."
"Connecticut?" They sat on the three-season porch at the back of the house, just 22 miles due north of the Connecticut border, and somehow it had never occurred to Rachel that her father could just as easily have taught not at one of the 5 colleges or the 15 other colleges on the Massachusetts side of the Berkshires, but just half an hour south in Connecticut.
"University of Hartford?" she asked Anne Marie.
Anne Marie pooched her lips and nose at the same time.
"I don't know. Could be."
Anne Marie put her arm around her.
"I wish I could help. And I wish you'd let it go, too."
"Why?" Rachel said, the eternal why, as she'd come to think of it. "Was he that bad?"
"I never heard he was bad,"
Anne Marie said with a minor slur and a sad grimace. She looked out through the screen at the stone-colored mist and the gray hills and spoke with a firm finality.
"Honey, I only heard that he'd moved on."
Her mother left everything to her in her will. It was less than Rachel would have imagined, but more than she needed at 21. If she lived frugally and invested wisely, she could conceivably live off her inheritance for 10 years. She found her mother's 2 yearbooks in a locked drawer in her office, North Adams High School and Smith College. She'd received her master's and PhD from Johns Hopkins. At 29, Rachel realized, Jesus. But the only record of that was the framed diplomas on the wall by the fireplace. She went through the yearbooks 3 times, forcing a snail's pace upon herself each time. She found, in total, 4 pictures of her mother, 2 formal, 2 as part of a group. In the Smith yearbook, she found no students named James because it was an all-girls school, but she did find 2 faculty members, neither of whom was the right age or had black hair. In the North Adams High School yearbook, she found 6 boys named James, 2 of whom could have been him, James McGuire and James Quinlan. It took her half an hour at the South Hadley Library computer to ascertain that James McGuire of North Adams had been paralyzed in a whitewater rafting accident while still in college. James Quinlan had majored in business administration at Wake Forest University and rarely left North Carolina, where he'd built a successful chain of teak furniture stores. The summer before she sold the house, she visited Berkshire Security Associates and met with Brian Delacroix, a private investigator. He was only a few years older than she was and carried himself with the rangy ease of a jogger. They met in his second-story office suite in an industrial park in Chicopee. It was a shoebox of an office, just Brian and a desk, 2 computers, and a row of file cabinets. When she asked where the associates in the firm name were, Brian explained that he was that associate. The main offices were in Worcester. His Chicopee satellite was a franchise opportunity, and he was just starting out. He offered to refer her to a more seasoned operative, but she really didn't feel like climbing back in her car and schlepping all the way to Worcester, so she rolled the dice and told him why she'd come. Brian asked a few questions and wrote on a yellow legal pad and met her eyes often enough for her to feel a simple tenderness in his that seemed older than his years. He struck her as earnest and knew enough at the business to still be honest, an opinion he validated 2 days later when he advised her not to hire him, or anyone else for that matter. Brian told her he could take her case and probably bill her for at least 40 hours of work before he came back with the same opinion he was offering now.
You don't have enough information to find this guy.
That's why I'm hiring you.
He shifted in his chair.
I did a little digging since our first meeting. Nothing big, nothing I'll charge you for.
I'll pay.
But enough. If he was named Trevor or even, heck, Zachary, we might have a chance of tracking down a guy who taught at one of over 24 institutions of higher learning in Massachusetts or Connecticut 20 years ago. But, Miss Childs, I ran a quick computer analysis for you, and in the last 20 years, at the 27 schools I identified as possibles, there have been 73. He nodded at her shocked reaction. Adjunct, fill-in, assistant, associate, and full professors named James. Some have lasted a semester, some less, and some have gone the other way and attained tenure.
Can you get employment records, pictures in the files?
I'm sure for some, maybe half. But if he's not in that half, and how would you even identify him, then we'd have to track down the other 35 Jameses who, if demographic trends in this country are an indicator, are flung across all 50 states, and find a way to get their pictures from 20 years ago. Then I wouldn't be charging you for 40 hours work. I'd be charging for 400, and still no guarantee we'd find this guy.
She worked through her reactions, anxiety, rage, helplessness, which produced more rage, and finally stubborn anger at this prick for not wanting to do his job. Fine, she'd find someone who would. He read that in her eyes and the way she gathered her purse to herself.
If you go to someone else and they see you, a young woman who recently came into some money, they will milk you for that money and still come up empty. And that larceny, which is what it will be in my opinion, will be perfectly legal. Then you'll be poor and fatherless.
He leaned forward and spoke softly.
Where were you born?
She tilted her head toward the south-facing window.
Springfield.
Is there a hospital record?
She nodded. Father is listed as unknown.
But they were together then, Elizabeth and James.
Another nod. Once, when she'd had a few drinks, she told me that the night she went into labor they were fighting, and he was out of town. She had me, and, because he wasn't there, she refused to list him on the record out of spite. They sat in silence until she said,
"So you won't take my case?"
Brian Delacroix shook his head.
"Let him go."
She stood, her forearms quaking, and thanked him for his time. She found photographs stashed all around the house, the nightstand in her mother's bedroom, a box in the attic, filling a drawer in her mother's office. A good 85% of them were of the two of them. Rachel was struck by how clearly love for her shone in her mother's pale eyes, though true to form, even in pictures, her mother's love looked complicated, as if she were in the process of reconsidering it. The other 15% of the pictures were of friends and colleagues in academia and publishing, most taken at holiday cocktail parties and early summer cookouts, two at a bar with people Rachel didn't recognize but who were clearly academics. None contained a man with dark wavy hair and an uncertain smile. She found her mother's journals when she sold the house. She'd graduated from Emerson by that point and was leaving Massachusetts for graduate school in New York City. The old Victorian in South Hadley, where she and her mother had lived since Rachel was in third grade, contained few good memories and had always felt haunted. "But they're faculty ghosts," her mother would say when the unexplained creak snaked out from the far end of a hallway or something thumped in the attic. "Probably up there reading Chaucer and sipping herbal tea." The journals weren't in the attic. They were in a trunk in the basement, underneath carelessly packed foreign editions of The Staircase. They filled lined composition notebooks, the entries as haphazard as her mother had been ordered in her daily life. Half were undated, and her mother could go months, once even a year, without writing. She wrote most often about fear. Prior to The Staircase, the fear was financial. She'd never make enough money as a professor of psychology to pay back her student loans, let alone send her daughter to a decent private high school and on to a decent college. After her book landed on the national bestseller lists, she feared she'd never write a worthwhile follow-up. She feared, too, that she would be called out for wearing the Emperor's new clothes, for perpetrating a con job that would be discerned when she published again. It turned out to be a prophetic fear. But mostly, she feared for Rachel. Rachel watched herself grow in the pages from a rambunctious, joyful, occasionally irritating source of pride. She has his appetite for play, her heart so lovely and generous that I'm terrified what the world will do to it, to a despairing and self-destructive malcontent. The cutting troubles me a bit less than the promiscuity. She's only 13, for Christ's sake. She leaps into dark waters and then complains about the depth, but blames me for the leaping. 15 pages later, she came upon, "I have to face the shame of it. I've been a subpar mother. I never had any patience for the underdeveloped frontal lobe. I snapped too much, cut to the chase when I should model patience. She grew up with a brusque reductionist, I'm afraid, and no father, and it put a hole at the center of her." A few pages later, her mother returned to the theme. "I worry she'll waste her life searching out things to fill the hole. Transitory things, soul baubles, new age therapies, self-medication. She thinks she's rebellious and resilient, but she's only one of those things. She needs so much." A few pages later, in an undated entry, Elizabeth Childs wrote, "She is laid up right now, sick in a strange bed, and even needier than usual. The persistent question returns, 'Who is he, Mother?' She looks so frail, brittle and mawkish and frail. She is a lot of wonderful things, my dearest Rachel, but she is not strong. If I tell her who James is, she'll search him out. He'll shatter her heart. And why should I give him that power? After all this time, why should he be allowed to hurt her again, to fuck with that beautiful, battered heart of hers? I saw him today." Rachel, sitting on the second-to-last step of the basement staircase, held her breath. She squeezed the edges of the journal, and her vision shimmied. "I saw him today. He never saw me. I parked up the street. He was on the lawn of the house he found after he abandoned us. And they were with him, the replacement wife, the replacement children. He's lost a lot of his hair and grown spongy above the belt line and below the chin. Small comfort. He's happy. God help me, he's happy. And isn't that the worst of all possible outcomes? I don't even believe in happiness, not as an ideal or as an authentic state of being. It's a child's goal, and yet he is happy. He'd feel that happiness threatened by this daughter he never wanted and wanted even less once she was born, because she reminded him of me, of how much he grew to loathe me, and he would hurt her. I was the one person in his life who refused to adore him, and he'd never forgive Rachel for that. He'd assume I told her unflattering things about him, and James, as we all know, could never abide criticism of his precious, earnest self." Rachel had been bedridden only once in her life, freshman year of high school. She'd contracted mononucleosis just as she was heading into Christmas break. The timing turned out to be fortuitous. It took her 13 days to get out of bed, and 5 more to regain the strength to return to school. In the end, she missed only 3 days of classes. But that would have been the window when her mother saw James, which was also when her mother was a visiting professor at Wesleyan. She'd rented a house in Middletown, Connecticut that year, and that was the strange bed Rachel had been confined to. Her mother, she recalled now with a disconcerted pride, had never left her during the illness except one time to get groceries and wine. Rachel had just started watching Pretty Woman on VHS and was still watching it when her mother returned. Her mother checked her temperature and opined that she found Julia Roberts' toothy grin cosmically grating before she brought the grocery bags into the kitchen to unload them. When she returned to the bedroom, glass of wine in one hand, warm, wet face cloth in the other, she gave Rachel a lonesome, hopeful look and said,
We did okay, didn't we?
Rachel looked up at her as she laid the face cloth across her forehead.
Of course we did, she said, because in that moment it felt like they had.
Her mother patted her cheek, looked at the TV. It was the end of the movie. Prince Charming, Richard Gere, showed up with flowers to rescue his hooker princess Julia. He thrust the flowers forward, Julia laughed and teared up, the music boomed in the background. Her mother said,
I mean, enough with the smiling already.
That put the entry of the diary at December 1992, or early January 1993. 8 years later, sitting on the basement steps, Rachel realized her father had been living somewhere within a 30-mile radius of Middletown. Couldn't be any more. Her mother had visited the street where he lived, observed him with his family, and then picked up groceries and stopped off at the liquor store for wine in under 2 hours. That meant James was teaching somewhere nearby, most likely at the University of Hartford.
If he was still teaching by that point,
Brian Delacroix said when she called him.
True.
But Brian agreed that there was enough to go on now so that he could take her case and her money and still look himself in the mirror in the morning. So in the late summer of 2001, Brian Delacroix and Berkshire Security Associates launched an investigation into the identity of her father and came up with nothing. No one by the name of James taught in higher education in Northern Connecticut that year who wasn't already well accounted for. One had blonde hair, one was African American, and the third was 27 years old. Once again, Rachel was told to let it go.
I'm leaving, Brian said.
Chicopee?
The business. So, yeah, Chicopee too. But I just don't want to be a private investigator. It's too grim, you know? All I seem to do is disappoint people, even when I deliver what they paid me to find. I'm sorry I couldn't help you, Rachel.
It hollowed out something in her. Another departure, another person in her life, however minor of impact, who would leave whether she wanted it to happen or not. She had no say.
What are you going to do? She asked.
I'm going to go back to Canada, I think.
His voice sounded strong, as if he'd arrived someplace he'd been meaning to arrive his whole life.
You're Canadian?
He chuckled softly.
Sure am.
What's back there?
Family lumber business. How's things with you?
Grad school is great. New York right now, she said. Less so.
It was late September 2001, less than 3 weeks after the towers fell.
Of course,
he said gravely.
Of course. I hope things look up for you. I wish you good things, Rachel.
She was surprised how intimate her name sounded when it fell from his tongue. She pictured his eyes, the tenderness there, and was mildly annoyed to realize she'd been attracted to him and had failed to acknowledge it when it could have mattered.
Canada, she said. Eh?
That soft chuckle of his.
Canada.
They said their goodbyes. In her basement apartment on Waverly Place in Greenwich Village, easy walking distance to most of her classes at NYU, she sat in the soot and ash of Lower Manhattan in the month after 9/11. The day of the attack, a thick dust grew woolen on her windowsills, the dust of hair and pieces of bone and cells piling up like a light snow. The air smelled burnt. In the afternoon, she wandered, ended up walking past St. Vincent's ER, where gurneys were lined up for patients who never arrived. In the days that followed, pictures began to appear on the walls and fences of the hospital, most often with a simple message, "Have you seen this person?" No, she hadn't. They were gone. She was surrounded by loss so much greater than any she'd experienced in her own life. Everywhere she turned, she saw grief and unanswered prayers and a bedrock chaos that took so many forms, sexual, emotional, psychological, moral, that it quickly became the thread and thrum that united them all. We are all lost, Rachel realized, and resolved to bandage her own wound as best she could, and never pick at the scab again. That autumn, she came across two sentences in one of her mother's journals that she repeated to herself as a mantra every night for weeks before going to bed. James, her mother wrote, was never meant for us, and we were never meant for him. Chapter 2. Lightning. She suffered her first panic attack in the fall of 2001, just after Thanksgiving. She was walking along Christopher Street and passed a woman her own age who sat on a black iron stoop under the arched entrance to an apartment co-op. The woman was weeping into her hands, a not uncommon occurrence back then in New York City. People wept in parks and bathrooms and on the A train, some silently, some with vigor and volume. It was everywhere. But you still had to ask, you still had to check. "Are you okay?" Rachel reached out to touch the woman. The woman recoiled. "What are you doing?" "I'm seeing if you're okay." "I'm fine." The woman's face was dry. She smoked a cigarette that Rachel hadn't noticed before. "Are you okay?" "Sure," Rachel said. "I was just..." The woman was handing her several tissues. "It's all right. Let it out." The woman's face was dry. Her eyes weren't red. She hadn't been covering her face. She'd been smoking a cigarette. Rachel took the tissues. She dabbed her face, felt the stream there, felt the tears welling under her nose, dripping off the sides of her jaw and the point of her chin. "It's all right," the woman repeated. She looked at Rachel like it wasn't all right. It wasn't all right at all. She looked at Rachel and then past Rachel, as if hoping to be rescued. Rachel mumbled several thank yous and stumbled off. She reached the corner of Christopher and Weehawken. A red van idled at the light. The driver stared at Rachel with pale eyes, smiled at her with teeth yellowed by nicotine. It wasn't just tears streaming out of her now. It was sweat. Her throat closed. She knew she was choking, even though she hadn't eaten that morning. She couldn't breathe. She couldn't fucking breathe. Her throat would not open. Neither would her mouth. She needed to open her mouth. The driver got out of the van. He approached her with his pale eyes and pale, hawkish face and ginger hair cut tight to his scalp, and when he reached her, he was black and a bit rotund. His teeth weren't yellow. They were copy paper white. He knelt by her. How had she ended up sitting on the sidewalk? His brown eyes large and fearful.
"You okay? You need me to call someone, miss? Can you stand? Here, here, take my hand."
She took his hand and he pulled her to her feet on the corner of Christopher and Weehawken. And it was no longer morning. The sun was dipping. The Hudson had turned a light amber. The round, kind man hugged her to him, and she wept into his shoulder. She wept and made him promise to stay with her, to never leave her. "Tell me your name," she said. "Tell me your name." His name was Kenneth Waterman, and of course she never saw him again. He drove her back to her apartment in his red van, which wasn't the big panel van that smelled of axle grease and soiled undergarments she'd imagined, but was instead a minivan with child seats in the middle row and Cheerio crumbs on the floor mats. Kenneth Waterman had a wife and three children and lived in Fresh Meadows, Queens. He was a cabinet maker. He dropped her home and offered to call someone on her behalf. But she assured him she was okay now. She was fine. It was just this city sometimes, you know? He gave her a long, worried look, but cars were stacking up behind them, and dusk was gathering. A horn blared, then another. He handed her a business card, Kenny's Cabinets, and told her to call him any time. She thanked him and got out of the minivan. As he drove away, she realized the van wasn't even red. It was bronze. She deferred her next semester at NYU, rarely left the apartment except to walk to her shrink in Tribeca. His name was Konstantin Prokop, and the only personal information he ever divulged was that his family and friends insisted on calling him Connie. Connie tried to convince her that the national tragedy she was using to shame herself out of recognizing the depths of her own trauma was doing her serious harm. There's nothing tragic about my life, Rachel said. Was it sad sometimes? Sure, whose wasn't? But I was well cared for and well fed and grew up in a nice house. I mean, boo-hoo, right? Connie looked across the small office at her.
Your mother withheld one of your most basic rights, your paternity, from you. She subjected you to emotional tyranny in order to keep you close.
She was protecting me.
From what?
Okay, Rachel corrected herself. She believed she was protecting me from myself, from what I might do with the knowledge.
Is that really why?
Why else? Rachel suddenly wanted to dive out the window behind Connie.
If someone has something you not only want, but truly need, what will you never do to that person?
Don't say hate them, because I hated her plenty.
Leave them, he said. You'll never leave that person.
My mother was the most independent person I've ever met.
As long as she had you clinging to her, she could appear to be. What happened once you were gone, though, once she could feel you pulling away?
She knew what he was driving at. She was the daughter of a psychologist, after all. Fuck you, Connie. Don't go there.
Go where?
It was an accident.
A woman you've described as hyper-alert, hyper-aware, uber-competent, who had no drugs or alcohol in her system the day of her death, that woman drives through a stop sign on a dry road in broad daylight.
So now I killed my mother.
That's the exact opposite of what I'm suggesting.
Rachel gathered her coat and bag. The reason my mother never practiced was because she didn't want to be associated with half-assed quacks like you. She shot the degrees on his wall a look. Rutgers, she scoffed and walked out. Her next drink, Tess Porter, had a softer touch, and the commute to her office was much shorter. She told Rachel they'd get to the truths of her relationship with her mother on Rachel's schedule, not her doctor's. Rachel felt safe with Tess. With Connie, she'd always felt he was poised to strike. So she, in turn, always felt poised to parry.
What would you say to him, you think, if you found him? Tess asked one afternoon.
I don't know.
Are you afraid?
Yes, yes.
Of him? What?
No. She thought about it. No, not of him, just of the situation. I mean, where do you start? Hey, Dad, fuck you've been for my whole life.
Tess chuckled, but then said, There was some hesitation there when I asked if you were afraid of him.
Really?
Rachel gazed at the ceiling for a bit. It's like she could contradict herself about him sometimes.
How?
Most times she described him in effeminate terms. Poor sweet James, she'd say, or dear sensitive James. Lots of eye rolls. She was too outwardly progressive to admit he wasn't masculine enough for her. I remember a couple of times she said, You've got your father's mean streak, Rachel, and I'm thinking, I've got my mother's mean streak, bitch. She gazed up at the ceiling again. Look for yourself in his eyes.
What's that?
Tess leaned forward in her chair.
It's something she said to me a couple times. Look for yourself in his eyes. Tell me what you find.
What was the context?
Alcohol.
Tess gave that a thin smile.
But what do you think she meant?
Both times she was pissed at me. I remember that much. I always took it to mean he, if he ever saw me, he'd...
She shook her head.
What?
Tess's voice was soft.
If he ever saw you, he'd what?
It took her a minute to compose herself.
He'd be disappointed.
Disappointed?
Rachel held her gaze for a bit. Repulsed. Outside, the streets grew enshrouded, as if something huge and otherworldly blotted out the sun and cast its shadow across the breadth of the city. The rain fell suddenly. The thunder sounded like the tire slaps of heavy trucks crossing an old bridge. The lightning was a distant crack.
"Why are you smiling?" Tess asked.
"Was I?" She nodded.
Something else my mother would say, particularly on days like today.
Rachel tucked her legs under her. She'd say she missed his smell. The first time I ever asked her what she meant, what he'd smelled like, she closed her eyes, sniffed the air, and said, "Lightning." Tess's eyes widened slightly. "Is that what you remember him smelling like?" Rachel shook her head. "He smelled like coffee." Her gaze followed the splash of the raindrops out the window. "Coffee and corduroy." She rebounded from that first bout of panic and low-grade agoraphobia in the late spring of 2002. She ran into a boy who'd been in her advanced research techniques class the previous semester. His name was Patrick Mannion, and he was unfailingly considerate. He was kind of doughy and had the unfortunate habit of squinting when he couldn't hear properly, which was often because he'd lost 50% of the hearing in his right ear in a childhood sledding accident. Pat Mannion couldn't believe Rachel kept talking to him after they'd exhausted the limits of discussing the one class they'd taken together. He couldn't believe she suggested they get a drink. And the look on his face when, back at his apartment a few hours later, she reached for his belt buckle was the look of a man who'd glanced up at the sky to check for clouds and witnessed angels passing overhead. It was a look that remained on his face, more or less, throughout their relationship, which lasted 2 years. When she did eventually break up with him, ever so gently, almost to the point of convincing him that it was a mutual decision, he stared back at her with a strange, brutalized dignity and said, "I never used to understand why you were with me. I mean, you're gorgeous and I'm so... not."
"You're..."
He held up a hand to stop her. "Then one day, about 6 months ago, it hit me. Love doesn't trump all for you. Safety does. And I knew sooner or later you'd dump me before I'd dump you because, and this is the important part, Rach, I would never dump you." He gave her a beautiful, broken smile. "And that's been my purpose all along." After grad school, she spent a year in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, on the Times Leader, and then returned to Massachusetts and quickly moved up to the Features Department at the Patriot Ledger in Quincy, where a story she wrote on racial profiling by the Hingham Police Department garnered some acclaim and enough attention that she received an email from Brian Delacroix, of all people. He'd been traveling for business and had come across a copy of the Ledger in the waiting room of a lumber distributor in Brockton. He wanted to know if she was the same Rachel Childs and if she had ever found her father. She wrote back that she was the same Rachel Childs and that no, she hadn't found her father. Would he care to take another stab at the job? "Can't. Slammed at work. Traveling, traveling, traveling. Take care, Rachel. You won't be at the Ledger long. Big things await. Love the way you write." He was right. A year after that, she made it to the majors and the Boston Globe. Which is where Dr. Felix Browner, her mother's OBGYN, found her. The subject line of his email was, "Old friend of your mom's," but once she responded to it, it became clear he was less a friend than someone Elizabeth Childs had utilized for medical purposes. Dr. Browner was also not the gynecologist her mother had been using by the time Rachel had knowledge of such things. When Rachel reached adolescence, Elizabeth had introduced her to Dr. Vina Rao, whom most of the women and young girls Rachel knew also used. She'd never heard of Felix Browner. But he assured her he had been her mother's doctor when Elizabeth first came to Western Massachusetts, and had, in fact, introduced Rachel herself to her first taste of oxygen. "You were a squirmy one," he wrote. In a subsequent email, he wrote that he possessed important information he'd like to share regarding her mother, but he only felt comfortable sharing it face-to-face. They agreed to meet halfway between Boston and Springfield, where he lived, and settled on a diner in Millbury. Before the meeting, she researched Dr. Browner, and the picture was, as her instincts had been telling her since his first email, not a flattering one. The year before, in 2006, he'd been barred from practicing medicine due to multiple allegations of sexual assault or sexual misconduct by female patients, the earliest dating back to 1976,
when the good doctor was only a week out of med school.
Dr. Browner brought two rolling file cases to the diner with him. At 62 or so, he wore his thick silver hair in the almost mullet, almost shag style of someone who drove a sports car and patronized Jimmy Buffett concerts. He wore light blue jeans, penny loafers without socks, and a Hawaiian shirt under a black linen blazer. He carried an extra 30 pounds around his middle, like a statement of success, and had an easy way with the waitress and the busboys. He struck her as the kind of man who is well-liked by strangers, but baffled if someone doesn't laugh at his jokes. After he'd expressed his sympathies for the death of Rachel's mother, he reminded her what a squirmy little newborn she'd been.
"Like you were dipped in Palmolive."
He then somewhat breathlessly revealed that his first accuser,
"We'll call her Leanne, and not just because it sounds like lion, okay?"
knew several of the other accusers. He ticked off their names, and Rachel immediately wondered if he was using aliases or if he was violating the women's right to privacy with cavalier indifference. Tanya, Marie, Ursula, Jane, and Patty, he said, all knew one another.
"Well, it's a small region," Rachel said. "People know each other."
"Do they?"
He shook a sugar packet before opening it and shot her a cold smile.
"Do they?"
He drizzled the sugar into his coffee, then reached into one of his file cases.
"Lion Leanne, I've discovered, has had numerous lovers. She's been divorced twice and..."
"Doctor..."
He held up a hand to silence her.
"And was named as the other woman in a divorce. Patty drinks alone, Marie and Ursula have substance abuse issues, and Tanya, Tanya sued another doctor for sexual assault."
He bulged his eyeballs in mock outrage.
"Apparently there's an epidemic of predatory doctors in the Berkshires. Heavens!"
Rachel had known a Tanya in the Berkshires. Tanya Fletcher managed the Minuteman Inn, always seemed distracted and a bit perturbed. Dr. Browner dropped a stack of paper the size of a cinder block on the table between them, arched a triumphant eyebrow at her.
"What?" Rachel said. "You don't believe in thumb drives?"
He didn't acknowledge that.
"I have the goods on all of them, you see. You see?"
"I see," Rachel said. "And what would you like me to do with that?"
"Help me,"
he said, as if it were the only answer in the world.
"And why would I do that?"
"Because I'm innocent. Because I didn't do a single wrong thing."
He turned his palms over and extended them across the table.
"These hands bring life into the world. They brought you into the world, Rachel. These hands were the first that ever held you. These hands."
He stared at them like they were his two great loves.
"Those women took my name."
He folded his hands together and looked down at them.
"I lost my family over all the stress and discord. I lost my practice."
Tears glistened in his lower eyelids.
"And I didn't deserve it. I did not."
Rachel gave him what she hoped would be a sympathetic smile, but suspected looked merely sickly.
"I'm not sure what you're asking of me."
He leaned back from the table.
"Write about these women. Show that they had an agenda, that they chose me to advance that agenda, that they set out to destroy me, and now they have. They need to atone. They need to recant. They need to be exposed. Now they're suing me in civil court. Do you know, young lady, that the average civil case costs $250,000 to defend? Just to defend. Win or lose, you're out $250,000. Did you know that?"
Rachel was still stuck on young lady, but she nodded.
So, this coven has raped me. What other word could apply? They have wrecked my good name and destroyed my relationships with my family and my friends. But that's not enough, is it? No, now they want to pick my bones. They want what little money I have left. So I can spend my remaining years destitute, so I can die on a cot in a shelter somewhere, a friendless nothing.
He splayed his fingers over the stack of paper.
In these pages are all the dirty facts about these dirty women. Write about them. Show the world who they are. I'm handing you your Pulitzer, Rachel.
I'm not here for a Pulitzer, Rachel said. His eyes grew small.
Then why are you here?
You said you had information regarding my mother. He nodded.
After.
After what?
After you do the story.
That's not how I work, Rachel said. If you have information about my mother, just tell me and we'll see.
It's not about your mother. It's about your father.
His eyes flashed.
As you yourself said, it's a small region. People talk. And the story about you, my dear, was that Elizabeth refused to tell you who your father was. We pitied you, you know, all the good townspeople. We wanted to tell you, but none of us could. Well, I could have. I knew your father quite well. But doctor-patient confidentiality laws being what they are, I couldn't reveal his identity against your mother's wishes. But now she's dead, and I'm no longer allowed to practice.
He sipped his coffee.
So, Rachel, would you like to know who your daddy is?
It took Rachel a moment to find her voice. Yes.
What's that?
Yes. He acknowledged that with a downward flick of his eyelids.
Then write the fucking story, sweetheart.
Chapter 3. JJ. The more Rachel dug into the court records and the very files Browner provided, the worse it got. If Dr. Felix Browner was not a serial rapist, he was giving the best impression of one Rachel had seen in some time. The only reason he wasn't in prison was because the one woman who had pressed charges within the statute of limitations, Leanne Fennigan, had overdosed on OxyContin the final week of his trial, just before she was set to testify. Leanne survived the overdose, but was in rehab the day she was supposed to deliver her testimony, and the DA accepted a plea that included revocation of the doctor's license, 6 years probation, 6 months time already served, and a gag order, but no prison time. Rachel wrote up her story. She brought it with her to the diner in Millbury, pulled it out of her bag as she sat across from Dr. Felix Browner. He gazed at the small sheaf of pages, but remained still.
What? He said. You don't believe in thumb drives?
She gave that a tight smile of acknowledgement.
You look happy.
He did. He'd shit-canned the Jimmy Buffett look for a crisp white shirt under a dark brown suit. His hair was slicked back and heavily gelled. His caterpillar eyebrows were trimmed. His face had color and his eyes gleamed with possibility.
I feel happy, Rachel. You look stupendous yourself.
Thank you.
That blouse brings out the green of your eyes.
Thank you.
Is your hair always so silky?
I just had a blowout.
It becomes you.
She beamed her own bright smile his way. His eyes pulsed when it landed, and he laughed a small private laugh.
Well, lordy, he said.
She said nothing, just nodded in a knowing way and held his gaze.
I think you can smell that Pulitzer.
Well, she said, let's not get ahead of ourselves. She handed the pages to him. He settled into his chair.
We should order drinks, he said
absently as he began to read. As he turned the first page, he looked across at her, and she smiled with encouragement. He read on, and his brow knitted as anticipation transmogrified into consternation, then despair, and finally outrage.
This,
he said, waving off the waitress's approach,
says I'm a rapist.
Kinda does, doesn't it?
This says the women's chemical dependency and alcohol abuse and sexual piggery are due to me.
Because they are.
This says I tried to extort you into wrecking these women's lives a second time.
Because you did. She nodded pleasantly. And you slandered them in my presence. And I bet if I did even a little digging at your local watering holes, I'd find evidence you slandered them to half the male population in Western Mass, which would be a violation of the terms of your probation. And that means, Felix, that when the Globe runs that story, you are going straight to fucking D-block. She sat back, watched him go speechless. When he finally met her eyes,
His swam with martyrdom and disbelief.
These hands, he raised them, brought you into the world.
Fuck your hands, she said. We have a new deal, okay? I won't file that story.
Bless you.
He sat up straight.
I knew the moment I...
Give me my father's name.
I'll be happy to.